BJ's Wholesale versus McCarran. Have each of you signed in?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, you may begin whenever you're ready. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
Would you like us to go up to the place or just at the table?
Up to the lectern would be great, please. Anytime you're ready.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Marilyn Harvey, and I represent the appellant, BJ's Wholesale Club, et al. Your Honors, I am well aware of the court's diligence in this matter, so I am assuming you know the facts. Therefore, I'm going to talk to you about the law. This case is dictated by Virginia Code Section 65.2-712, the Favinger case, and the Massey cases. The case of Ward versus Bosch and Mom, which the claimant cited, is also particularly illustrative. Section 65.2-712 creates a duty for the claimant to immediately report to the employer or insurer any return to employment or increase in her earnings. Any payment to a claimant made by an employer or an insurer that is later determined to be procured by the employee failing to return to her employment or report her increase in earnings may be recovered by a credit against future compensation payments due to the claimant. The purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is to compensate injured workers for lost wages, not to unjustly enrich them. The Commission did not find any authority for affording the employer a credit for all compensation paid under the June 26, 2012 award order in either their March 20, 2015 opinion or their October 14, 2016 opinion. According to the Commission's 2015 decision, which they relied on in their 2016 decision, the Commission agreed the employer was entitled to a credit, but stated there had been neither allegations nor findings of fraud or misrepresentation. Therefore, the statutory requirements of 65.2-712 were not met. An employer is not required to prove fraud or misrepresentation. It just must prove the claimant failed to report their return to employment. The statute specifically says, or failure to report, and any payment. A credit under 712 is limited to the amount the employee receives in excess of that which she should have received had she reported the return to employment. The Commission relied on Coburn to emphasize the limitations in 712 and make clear the Commission's inability to award a credit outside of those limits. The Commission also relied on Lotmasters versus Gibbs for the premise that 712 makes no provision for vacating outstanding awards. This is not an issue that is before the court today, and Gibbs was a very unique case that interpreted the contents of a pre-printed form. I am not asking for an award.
Ms. Harvey, I interrupt you? I hate to do that, time goes by so fast when these cases are being argued. When you look at the language of 65.2-712,
yes.
It says that may be recovered from the claimant or statutory dependent by the employer or insurer either by way of credit against future compensation payments due to the claimant or by an action at law.
Yes.
So, given the word future, how do we come around to your view on this?
Well, we have agreed that she's entitled to medical benefits for treatment for her, I believe it's her shoulder. I can't recall at the moment. So we would recover our credit against those benefits. We wouldn't pay anything else.
Compensation payments as opposed to medical treatment or medical payments. Isn't there a difference there?
There is a difference between indemnity payments and medical treatment, but it has been shown before that you can recover against future medical payments issued to providers.
So your argument is not for full restitution. You're not arguing that.
No.
You're saying it can be recovered against anything paid in the future, including all payments for medical treatment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And we are not asking for a credit that's outside the limits of 712. We are asking for a credit for any payment which we argue, is all of the payments that were made to the claimant because she failed to report her return to employment. We are not requesting restitution. It is undisputed that the claimant continued working at St. Gregory's the entire time she was out of work pursuant to her doctor's orders. As a result, she was obviously capable of light-duty work. As such, per Favinger, in order for her to receive temporary partial disability benefits, she would have had to market her residual work capacity. Claimant stipulated that she did not market her residual work capacity. So my client would never have agreed to enter into an award for temporary partial disability benefits. Therefore, the claimant was entitled to absolutely no indemnity benefits. The credit my client is entitled to is the full amount of the indemnity benefits paid because the claimant would not have been entitled to temporary partial disability benefits. Why should the claimant be entitled to temporary partial disability benefits without the requirements associated with the receipt of those benefits? In fact, in Ward versus Bosch and Lomb, the commission awarded a credit for all payments of compensation made since the date when temporary total disability benefits were terminated and determined the defendants were entitled to credit for all payment of compensation made since the termination. The situation was very similar to the case because in Ward, the claimant claimed her supervisor always knew she had another job, but the commission did not find that information persuasive. Therefore, the commission has previously provided a credit for all compensation paid pursuant to 65.2-712. Claimant's counsel argues the employer is arguing the claimant has to retroactively show marketing to show the remaining benefit entitlement. He premises this argument on the fact that the claimant was on a temporary total disability award. Therefore, she had no duty to market. Claimant was on the temporary total disability award because she violated Section 65.2-712 and did not report her return to work. As Commissioner Williams noted in his dissent, here the claimant is allowed to receive temporary total disability.
You know, does it create any kind of problem when you talk about didn't report her return to work? She didn't return to work. She'd been doing that job for 10 years. So it's not really a return, is it?
It's not a return in the sense that she went back to BJ's. BJ's was operating under the premise that she was not capable of performing any work. But she continued to work while she was on a no-duty status. She didn't miss a single day when she was working for St. Gregory's. So it's not necessarily returning to work for BJ's, but it's returning to work in general. So
wasn't there evidence in the record, though, that the job responsibilities were very different at St. Gregory's and at BJ's? How does that affect the analysis here?
That would go into whether or not she was entitled to temporary partial disability benefits because she could have been released to light duty. And then in order to receive her temporary partial disability benefit, she would have had to market whatever residual work capacity she did have, whether she continued working at St. Gregory's and picked up a different job. She obviously was capable of some form of light-duty employment. She may not have been capable of working at BJ's in the position she was in, but we don't know whether or not she was capable of working in a position, say, as a cashier or another type of position where they could have accommodated restrictions that she obviously could have operated under. The only reason that this award for temporary partial disability benefits in this case is being allowed is because she was on a temporary total disability award because she concealed that she was working for St. Gregory's. Claimant was required by law to disclose her employment and abide by Favinger, yet she is being exempt. Claimant's argument also makes Section 65.2-712 moot. There is absolutely no penalty for a claimant not complying with the statute and informing the employer or the insurer that they have returned to work or received an increase in earnings. Rather, there is an incentive to be ignorant and fall back onto what you would have been entitled to receive if you were under a temporary partial disability award. Claimant's argument rewards ignorance, as the saying goes, ignorance is bliss, and in this claimant situation, profitable. I argue ignorance of the law is no excuse, and my client should be entitled to a credit for all indemnity benefits paid in excess of what the claimant was entitled to, which was nothing. If there are no further questions, I respectfully ask the court to reverse the commission's decision that my client is entitled to a credit only for the increase in earnings the claimant experienced, and determine my client is entitled to a credit for all indemnity benefits it paid pursuant to the claimant's failure to report her return to work.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. Mr. Kraft?
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Kraft. I'm here on behalf of Rose McCarron, the appellee in this matter. I'm first going to address a couple issues raised by the court and kind of give some background. The first thing that should be considered is this case falls within an adjunct of what's called the dissimilar employment rule. The idea there is when a person is working when they get hurt and they have two different jobs, which are different in substance, different in tasks, different in requirements, those two jobs are not combined to determine the average weekly wages, which is what is used to determine what benefits are paid. The idea is they're dissimilar, they should not be combined. If they are similar, they can be combined. By the same token, the Commission and the Court of Appeals have consistently held that in a situation where an employee returns back to work in the dissimilar employment after their work injury, the earnings in that position are not considered in determining their benefits unless those earnings increase beyond the level they were before and then therefore impact the post-injury wage earning capacity and average weekly wage. That is the situation in this case, according to the Commission. The Commission basically found that she did not report a return to work. She had continued to work, but that there was a non-reporting of some very minor increases in the post-injury earnings in the St. Gregory's job. So that's some of the context. There was no finding that there was any fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct, so to speak, on the part of the claimant, that she actively or knowingly concealed anything to the employer and carrier. At the hearing, she actually testified that she did indicate she had continued in that employment when she was questioned about that. So in evaluating the case in terms of the equities, I think the court should consider the fact that the commission also didn't look at this case as one involving some kind of misconduct on the part of the claimant. It was simply an issue that she didn't know she had to report, she didn't report, and those increased earnings did impact the application of Section 712.
A responsibility to report that she had that job and was continuing to work it.
How did she have it, or how did she?
Why did not she have a responsibility? Why shouldn't she have had to report that?
712, I think, does impose the responsibility for her to report the increase in earnings. She was an unrepresented claimant at the time that the award order was entered. And
so you're referring to the increase of earnings from one year to the next when she got the raise.
Correct.
But they didn't even know she was working the job, right?
I beg to differ on that. I don't know that that was necessarily the finding. She did testify. The only testimony that did come in was that everybody at the employer knew that she was working there and that she continued working there and did notify the carrier, the adjuster, in the first conversation that she had with the adjuster within a week of the actual injury. So that's my understanding of the facts in the case as it was presented to the commission. There was no contrary evidence to that. Now, the other important backdrop in this case is the issue of the open award order and the application of Favinger as addressed by the opposing counsel. The commission treats award orders obviously just like any judicial order. They are an order providing for payment of certain benefits. In this case, they provide for medical benefits and the payment of what's called temporary total disability benefits from the date following the injury and continuing. That award order was entered by agreement between the parties at a time when the claimant was on restricted duty. The employer and carrier presented no evidence that they required any showing of marketing under Favinger or otherwise in order to enter that award order. She had been released to light duty already at that point, that the agreement forms were signed and that the award order was entered. The employer and carrier did not appeal that award order. That became final within 30 days, as cited in claimant's brief. Any argument, therefore, based on Favinger, based on any marketing, in our view, is disingenuous and is not supported by the current record before the court. They presented no evidence that they generally require that or have a policy of requiring that, and in this case, they did not require that. In addition, the claimant's position is that Fattinger doesn't even come into this case, that this case falls under Section 712, 65.2712, and as the Commission found, that provision provides for a specific remedy. And that remedy is limited. It does not include vacating the prior award order. It treats the award order as though it is still in place. It simply awards a credit based on the increased earnings in the dissimilar employment. That's what the Commission did in this case, and if you look at their order, their award, that's what they did. They said the award, the prior temporary total disability award is terminated, but the employer is granted a credit for the increase in, based directly on the increased earnings in the dissimilar employment job. So our position is that the Commission correctly interpreted and applied Section 712 in accordance with all prior precedent addressing that section. That includes this Court's decision in Massey. If you look at the underlying decision in Massey, that is the direct calculation that was done by the Commission below and affirmed by the Court on appeal. The Commission determined that there had been an increase in earnings. They figured out that increase in earnings, and they awarded credit in that amount. I'll read from that, if you'll indulge me. The exact amount that the Commission awarded in that case was $126.20 per week based on that exact increase in earnings in the dissimilar employment. So that's what this Court has previously applied. That's what the Commission has previously applied in all cases, including the cases cited by the employer and carrier. Focusing on the Magic City decision, Magic City Motor Corp. versus Helmick case, which is a case strongly relied upon by the employer and carrier. In that case, the Court of Appeals sent the case back to the Commission, remanded the case for determination by that court as to whether or not an employer would have entered into a settlement agreement had the claimant in that case disclosed that they were continuing working and receiving earnings. At the same time, even in that case, which applied Section 712 to a settlement agreement, saying that it could be applied to a settlement agreement in addition to an award order, even in that case, the Commission in the lower decision had limited the credit to the amount of the earnings. They had not allowed the full recoupment of the settlement or elimination of the settlement. They simply said, okay, the credit or the provision 712 allows for a credit, and that's it. And it can be either applied against future compensation benefits or can be recouped through an action law against the claimant. To clarify one point.
Since you just mentioned future compensation payments, can you address your opposing counsel's argument that it can be recouped against medical payments?
I respectfully disagree with that. I think it can only apply against compensation benefits.
And what authority do you cite for?
I believe the statute itself includes that language. I might look at it. Future compensation. It says either by way of credit against future compensation benefits due to the claimant or statutory dependent, or by action of law against the claimant or statutory dependent. That's why I believe it only applies to compensation. And in the cases that I've reviewed, it appears that the credit is only applied against compensation benefits as opposed to medical benefits. I mentioned just a couple other cases. I won't go into details. They're generally covered in the claimant's brief, the appellant's brief. The Goodell decision, the Skiba decision, the Shaw decision. There's an additional decision from the Commission in 2016 that followed McCarran called Mustafa versus Allstate Termite Control Company, JCN VA 00000841610. I mention those only for illustration to the extent that this has been a long-standing principle before the Commission and the Court of Appeals. The employer and carrier's argument for 100% credit, to my knowledge, has not been awarded in any case. The award decision that was referenced by opposing counsel did award 100% credit, but that was a very distinct situation. In that case, the claimant had returned back to work at an average weekly wage, combined average weekly wage in the post-injury work, which exceeded the pre-injury average weekly wage. So calculating the credit would be 100% in that case. In this case, you're talking a very marginal amount of increase that resulted in credit figures, in this case, of $6.76 for one period, and then a smaller amount for another period, $5.73, for a total credit in this case of $363.13. In terms of balancing the equities, to the extent that that comes into the court's decision-making process in this case, again, we point to the fact that Ms. McCarron did not know the requirement, did not intentionally conceal any facts. There's no fraud, misrepresentation. In this case, we're talking about a credit of $363 versus a claim for a credit on the part of the employer and carrier in the amount of approximately $20,000 to $21,000. In our opinion, both the strict reading of the statute that gives the limited remedies that were applied in this case by the commission, the prior cases interpreting and applying that provision, those both support the determination by the commission in this case, and we respectfully ask that this court, affirm the decision from the commission. Okay? Does the court have any other questions?
A little more on Why the job at St. Gregory's and this are dissimilar. I think I know what you're going to say, but I'd like to just hear it.
The commission generally looks at the job responsibilities. What does it physically require? And in this case, in the St. Gregory job, the claimant worked setting up for bingo on Friday night. She worked light janitorial work. In the BJ's wholesale job, she was a bakery manager. That involved more heavy lifting. I think the evidence indicated that the job responsibilities required more heavy lifting, up to, I think, 40 to 50 pounds in the bakery job, as opposed to, I believe, lifting up to maybe 10 pounds in the light janitorial job with St. Gregory's. So the commission looks at those and makes a determination as to whether or not they overlap and how much they overlap, and making a decision as to whether or not to combine those wages in the pre-injury and post-injury analysis. In this case, this party's actually stipulated that jobs were dissimilar. There was not sufficient overlap in the case to consider either including in the pre-injury average weekly wage or including in the post-injury analysis, except to the extent that those earnings increased. If there are no other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Ms. Harvey, you got some time for rebuttal if you'd like to use it.
Yes, please, Your Honor.
I would first like to address claimant's counsel's argument that you should balance the equities when determining whether or not his client knowingly failed to report her return to employment. As I discussed, there's no requirement that you have to prove that there was fraud or misrepresentation. She just has to fail to report her return to employment. Because she didn't know, why should she be exempt from the law? The law is that she has to report her return to employment. And she was on a no-duty status, but while her doctor had her on a no-duty status, she didn't miss a single day from work at St. Gregory's.
So then why is Judge Baumgartner asked, why is that a return to employment if she never left it?
Well, she never left it, but she was told to leave it by her doctor. She was put on a complete no-duty, no-work status. Thus, us instituting temporary total disability, an award agreement, but she...
Where is it that the doctor told her that she had to stop working at that job?
I was under the impression...
He told her she had to stop... She couldn't work at the job on which she was injured. But where is it that he told her she couldn't keep working at St. Gregory's? Is that the name of it?
Yes, St. Gregory's is a Catholic church.
There's nothing about that in the record, is it?
That is not in the record, but generally when a doctor puts you on a no-work duty status, it applies to all work that you have and you take it to all your employers. I'm unable to say whether or not she told her doctor that she also had a job at St. Gregory's, because I cannot surmise whether or not she said that, and if she did say that, the doctor most likely would have taken her out of that work too, because her injuries at BJ's were substantial. They were
That's
not.
That's all subjection, isn't it? I mean, why would the doctor even inquire about this other job? He sent her because she was injured on the job at BJ's.
I can't say whether or not or why he would inquire about that job. I don't know. I wasn't in his position. I don't know the exact information he had before him. But then if we were to impose a duty onto doctors to ask, well, is this the only job you have? You were hurt here. But then now you have to say, do you have any other jobs too that I need to take you out of a no work status on? I believe his note just said no work. It didn't say no work at BJ's. It just said no duty, no work.
If the jobs are accepted as being dissimilar, which is the case here.
Yes.
Why would you think that if you couldn't work at one job, that it would necessarily keep you from working at a job that is different by definition?
I would argue it's because of the extent of her injuries and because of the doctor's no duty status, that if you can't work at one job, why should you work at the other job? And then when you're talking to the employer's representative in the transcript, I'd like to direct you to page 131 of the record. It's a transcript, a hearing transcript. And Mr. Rappaport asked, but did you tell them you were still working at your second job, or did you simply say, I have a second job? Claimant says, I don't remember the exact words I used. I can't swear to that. Mr. Rappaport said, because they take a recorded statement, correct? And she says, I'm sure they do. And then they asked you, do you have any other employment? She said yes. And you said yes. And she said yes. But you didn't tell them that you were continuing to work your second job while on disability from BJ's. I don't know if I specifically said. I don't know if they specifically asked me. I wasn't trying to lie or be dishonest about anything. The claimant could not state for sure that she did report to the insurer or the employer that she had returned to work. And as the Ward versus Bosch and Lohm case states, in that case, the claimant said that her boss knew the whole time that she had a different job and that therefore she had reported it. The commission disagreed with that assertion. But this case comes down to the fact that claimant is now being given temporary partial disability benefits against the law, against Fabinger. She didn't have to market her residual work capacity. She didn't have to do any of the requirements associated with receiving temporary partial disability benefits because she was on a temporary total disability award due to her failure to comply with the law.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. Consistent with the tradition of the court, we will come down and greet counsel and then